You're listening to Lanyap, a weekly digest of news, personal finance, brotherly banter, and whatever else is on our minds. From Stokes Family Office.
Stokes Family Office, this is Greg Stokes with my brother Doug. Today is September 27th, 2023. It's been a wild week in the markets since the Fed came out with their guidance last week regarding the fact that they were going to keep rates higher for longer. The market doesn't quite buy that they're going to be raising one more time. But the market does buy that the rates are going to be higher for longer, and they've reacted pretty negatively as a result. Markets are off probably like 7% or so from their all-time highs. Interestingly enough, if you take out the big dogs in the market, Facebooks, Apples, Microsoft, etc., the equal weighted market is actually slightly down on the year. So if you just averaged all 500 stocks in the S&P 500, all stocks are on an average basis down on the year. The market cap, S&P 500 is up though, of course. And if you look at the actual, the smaller companies, the iShares Microcap ETF is down like 8 or 9% on the year. So the markets on the whole look good this year, but if you look under the surface, there's a little bit of turbulence. So as it relates to things that have been going on in around New Orleans, the Saints had a pretty tragic loss this past weekend. Fortunately, Derek Carr doesn't look like he's seriously injured, but those are the things that I'm thinking of off the top of my head, and we've got a lot to talk about, but tough loss for the Saints this weekend and a pretty choppy market over the last week or so.
Yeah, looking at the major indices, S&P up 11%, equal weighted index is flat. So essentially what you're saying there is that the market is top heavy. The moniker this year has been the Magnificent Seven, which is essentially FANG, and then we're adding NVIDIA into that now, is really carrying the market. And then the Russell 2000, which is small cap, is flat, 0% this year. Dow Jones is flat, it's up 1% this year. It has no real growth in that index. And so you would expect that the Dow would trail the S&P in a big growth year, and then a year like 2022, where it's a negative growth year, the Dow substantially outperformed the S&P. Index return from market highs, January 3rd, 2022, S&P is now down 11% since January of 2022. The NASDAQ still down 17% despite having a gangbusters year this year. It just was off so much last year that it hasn't clawed its way back. Russell 2000 is still in a bear market, down 22% since January of 2022, and the Dow Jones is down 8%. So despite the Dow lagging substantially in 2023, just because it wasn't as volatile last year, it's still outperforming since the beginning of 2022. CNN's Fear and Greed Index has been just flowing around pretty dramatically. It's a 26 out of 100, so 0 to 25 is extreme fear. So we're right on the line between extreme fear and fear in the market. A month ago, we were neutral. A week ago, we were neutral. And so it's just crazy how quickly sentiment changes in this market. And I think that's something that's been, with the social media era, something that's occurred a lot more rapidly. And we saw that with COVID, but there's swings in the market happen a lot more dramatically. It's seemingly more dramatically now than they had in the past. And so we're really seeing
that.
That's
crazy. All of a sudden, everybody's extremely bearish after like one bad week in the market.
Yeah, exactly. It's so funny. I'll tell you this. I'm going to go on a limb and make a call. I don't think this is that controversial, but I think it's worthwhile saying. I think that in the next several months, and today included, will be a pretty good opportunity and maybe for several years, one of the great opportunities to buy fixed income. The 10-year treasury is now above 4.5%. High quality municipal bonds with average duration are north of 4%. And for you know, guys like you and me that came into the investment business in the zero interest rate world, seeing a 4 or 5% handle on fixed income, specifically high quality fixed income, is essentially unheard of.
That's awesome.
So if we can go out, 10 years to buy a municipal bond that's A rated or higher, paying 4% for somebody that's in the highest tax bracket, that's like earning a 6 to 7% yield in tax equivalent bonds, and it's hard to pass that up. You can make the case for stocks, and somebody that's young, I always encourage stocks over bonds, simply because over a long enough time horizon, you would expect a premium for taking risk in equities. But dang, I mean, fixed income right now is pretty attractive, especially with inflation falling.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough though. Just like people in the stock market don't want to be buying right now, there's extreme fear. I think that same, you could say the same thing in the bond markets, because yields have gone up so much over the last several years. The prices of bonds have gone down dramatically. This is a chart from Bloomberg that was posted to Twitter. The 30-year treasury that was issued in 2020 was paying, and which is so matures in 2050, is now trading at 48 cents on the dollar. So people that bought these things at par, meaning they paid $100 for these things 3 years ago, have lost basically half their money, and eventually these things will mature at par again. But the people have lost money significantly in the fixed income world over the last several years that have gone at far, like 30 years like this. The same thing.
Imagine not refinancing during 2020 and 2021. That's when those bonds were taken out. But and I think the reason why you're seeing fixed income and companies generally, we talked about this on a podcast before, perform well in this environment is because they took out debt at such low rates. And so increased costs of capital through interest rates in 2023 and late 2022, not really affecting yet, at least not really affecting companies. And that's a good example of, they were issued bonds at 1 or 2%, at $100 par value. Now they're worth 50 cents on the dollar. Who benefits there? The company that issued the bond at $100 par
value. Yeah, you're exactly right. Just like the mortgagor, or the person that borrows money from a bank is going to benefit for the lifetime of that mortgage. Corporations, they were issuing debt, and they were issuing a ton of debt at that period of time. So that, in hindsight, was a great decision by people that were borrowing money to do anything, really. It's pretty crazy in the bond market that the yields have gone up so dramatically. People have gotten burned by owning these things. Long-dated bonds, intermediate-dated bonds, basically any bond has been a poor investment over the last several years. But prospectively, I agree with you. I think that's... It's just a natural conclusion that eventually the Fed's being so adamant that they're going to make sure that inflation gets back to 2%. And if you can lock in 4 or 5% or a spread of 2 or 3% above that that baseline inflation rate, which is what the Fed is striving for a long period of time, then it should be a sort of risk-free rate of return, real rate of return over inflation. So it's a pretty interesting dynamic that exists in the marketplace and the fixed income and equity side of the equation. If you look at the prognostications as it relates to what people and entities are thinking regarding the markets, it's been really kind of crummy last week. September has not been a good month. But if you look back at historically, Septembers are not, the market has seasonality. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard about the Santa Claus rally. So December tends to be a better month. They say you've heard the saying, sell in May and go away. September is also a traditionally a pretty bad month in the markets. There's obviously we don't subscribe to the whole concept of seasonality in terms of allocating our clients' capital, because there's things that happen all the time that their seasonality has nothing to do with a world event or whatever. So like, let's say Russia invades Ukraine and their markets have a 10 or 15% correction. I don't know exactly when that took place, but that could have taken place in a seasonably good month. And so there's really no, we don't really subscribe to market timing as relates to managing clients' money, but that doesn't change the fact that it's interesting and it can be a good educational tool. So that being said, September has been a pretty poor month in the markets. So no surprise here, especially the back half of September. And this individual, Ryan Dietrich, who works for Carson Investment Research, tracks this stuff pretty closely. And what he said that I think that there's some, like I said, you can subscribe some sort of historical precedence to all this. But he says that when stocks are down more than 1% in August and September, it hasn't always been a bad thing. In fact, Q4 has been higher 12 out of the last 13 times, when October has historically been a good period of time. So there's really no surprise, really, that September is not a good month, because it usually isn't a good month in the markets. And usually,
I think we talked about this at around mid-year. This is, if you recall, J.C. Peretz, who's a similar technical analyst as Dietrich, put out a pre-election cycle chart. And this is another seasonality type discussion, and not something that you really want to trade on, but it's something that at least puts this market action in context. He said it shows the S&P average performance in every year three presidential cycle since 1950 compared to 2023. Stocks typically follow a predictable pattern in year three. They surge the first half of the year, trade sideways in the late summer and fall, and then rip higher into Christmas. There's your Santa Claus rally. So year three of a presidential cycle has typically been the best. We talked about that a few months ago. However, the back half of year three is choppy before typically it had ended higher. So not a really surprise, and this is a pretty typical seasonal pattern for at least presidential cycles.
Yeah, and this is from JP Morgan's trading desk, and I quote, shifting back to being tactically bullish on a combination of stabilizing-improving macro data, a positive earnings period, buybacks to resume, improved seasonality. We may have more downside this week, but shifting to buying this dip Friday and next week is what they're thinking. And then if you look at another individual who we like to quote often, this morning, Jim Cramer tweeted, don't bite on the first futures rally, wait for a test. But then I'll leave that with a quote from Winston Churchill, is that the greatest lesson in life is to know that even fools are right sometimes. So the bottom line is we have had a difficult September. If you look back at history, that's typical, and October and November, December can be good months. Nobody knows, obviously. And Jim Cramer is bearish, which I guess is probably a good sign, good contrarian sign. But then as Winston Churchill said, and as we say, a broken clock is right twice a day. So sometimes people like Cramer can be right, and bearishness can prevail.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So moving on, I think another bearish take in this particular market is what's called moving averages. And so one thing that Lizanne Saunders, I just talked about her as it relates to market performance through year-to-date 2023 and then since January of 2022. But the breadth of this market and what was carrying the market for much of this year were those seven stocks. So we had a flat market that for the equal weighted index, but the S&P was up double digits, and that was driven by really a handful of companies. What Lizanne's talking about here is percentage of stocks, sector and index members above their 200-day moving average. And the biggest outlier here is energy. 91% of energy companies are really outperforming right now. So this is a flashback to last year, where you had a strong dollar, you had rates increasing, you had high price of oil, and everything besides energy was getting hit as a result of that. Greg, any insight as to what's going on in oil markets and how essentially the price of oil we talked about has gone from about $60 to $90 over the last 3 months, and just market impacts as a result of that?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Like you mentioned, oil has increased dramatically, and it hasn't increased as on a percentage basis this much in years. But if you look back, so right now it's pretty expensive to fill up your gas tank for those people that have internal combustion engine vehicles versus external combustion engine vehicles, which are if you have a like a battery powered, you're running on fossil fuels as well, but it's being produced in a power plant. But anyway, so price of oil right now is $93 a barrel, which is expensive. It costs, you know, $100 to fill up if you've got an SUV or whatever. More expensive if you've got a truck. But if you look at that on a percentage basis relative to what people were paying on an inflation adjusted basis back in 2008, oil prices were actually much higher on a relative basis back then. Even though oil prices are expensive now, they're about 50% less on an inflation adjusted basis relative to 2008. So pretty expensive to fill up your gas tank, but still not as expensive on a relative basis as it was historically.
I think the price of oil is the biggest risk to our thesis around tailwinds for deflationary structure. So we had talked about, we basically talked about on every podcast that that housing is a decline in rental rates, which we expect would be a tailwind to our thesis around a disinflationary or as a softer landing on inflation or potentially deflation. And I think the biggest risk of that is going to be the price of oil. And the reason for that is that core CPI doesn't include what they call volatile inputs like price of oil or groceries, even though that's essentially what people spend their money on. But oil also is a major input in basically every manufacturing process. And so if you have...
And like opinion sentiments too. Like
right. So if you have the 90 or...
Right. The president, yeah. The president's opinion ratings, if you correlate that to the price of people to fill up their gas tank, it's pretty crazy. Yeah.
And I think inflation expectations, there's a correlation between expected inflation and the inflation rate in general. So if you expect the cost of goods to increase in the future, then you may spend more money now versus deferring that spending and spending it at a higher rate at some point in the future. So you may spend more now, which is essentially a vicious cycle of inflation, because people are spending more now, which causes price of goods to go up in anticipation of price of goods going up in the future. And then that loop sort of reinforces itself. And so just high price of oil is just never a good thing from an inflationary perspective. And it's also one of our biggest concerns as it relates to the thesis around disinflation. And so we would need to see that come down. One way to do that is to encourage more drilling. You would expect that OPEC plus there would be some agreement around curbed drilling on their side just to reduce the volatility of the price of oil. Maybe there's a resolution to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. But again, I think one of the risks to this market is a similar risk that we had last year, is this energy sort of taking off and impacting all other sectors of the economy and impacting sentiment as a result.
Yeah, there was actually an article in the Wall Street Journal about how oil companies obviously benefit from the utilization of oil and gasoline, et cetera. But even oil companies don't want the price, according to this Wall Street Journal article, which I thought was sort of counterintuitive. Oil companies don't want the price of oil to be too high, because then that consumers essentially utilize less gasoline, and that can become entrenched behavior. So they want stability as well too in the prices. Obviously, we want stability and high price of oil as well too, but not so much that it discourages people from consuming oil or it affects the broader economy. So there's a lot of dynamics at play and a lot of things that you wouldn't things that are counterintuitive like that. And I agree that is really sort of an important dynamic that's going to have to evolve, and it's going to affect the macro economy, which it always does. And I just always think back as far as like since we had been in the business, which is, you know, over 10 years or whatever, that we got into the business when interest rates were basically nothing and oil was irrelevant for a long period of time, essentially for the last 10 years. And then in COVID, it got to be negative. Oil companies or private equity shops based in New Orleans, they were sort of like the sexy job in the late 2000s, shut down. So oil was basically not a cool thing. We talked about this also in the past, how if you look at the number of graduate students or undergraduate students at a lot of public universities that major in petroleum engineering. That's also fallen off of a cliff. But all of a sudden, oil is a part of the conversation in a big way. One thing that was not a part of the was a part of the conversation that nobody's really talking about a whole lot right now is cryptocurrency. That was just, we both were fielding calls, I would say, at least on a weekly basis for a couple of years there related to Bitcoin and SafeMoon and all this crap, essentially, that was being shilled by social media people. And anyway, so I saw JP Morgan recently. This is a snapshot that somebody sent out, posted on Twitter. Our policy around crypto is changing. And the bottom line of the article is from October 16th, 2023. If we think you are, this is verbatim from JP Morgan Chase. If we think you are making a payment related to crypto assets, we will decline it. If you'd still like to invest in crypto assets, you can use a different bank or provider instead. They basically are avoiding that whole space altogether. So I don't know how that's all going to turn out, but it's certainly not a good thing. If you're bullish on crypto, if the largest bank in the world, or I don't know if they're the largest bank in the world, one of the largest banks in the world is avoiding it, I'm sure that other entities are going to follow suit because there is a lot of nefarious illegal activity that's related to utilization of crypto, paying ransomware, et cetera. They're just, JP Morgan's had enough.
Yeah. So just for context, that's JP Morgan UK. So it's not the entire company, but again, I think that's the sentiment amongst the banking sector is, they were opening the big story around Bitcoin in 2020 and 2021 was the institutionalization of cryptocurrency. So you had groups like Tesla, for example, was putting Bitcoin on balance sheet, or some insurance companies had Bitcoin on balance sheet. And then all of a sudden, that as soon as Bitcoin went from $70,000 a coin to $20,000 a coin, and all of the FTX grifters started come to the surface. The old adage that when the tide goes out, you can see who's swimming naked. As soon as that happened and all the banks realized that the industry is ripe with fraud, they decided they didn't want to be involved with it anymore. And so you're starting to see that percolate across that particular industry. We'll see if that crypto survives it. I'm sure it will. I mean, I think if Bitcoin hasn't been killed yet, it's hard to imagine that it does after the amount of negative and bear market sentiment that's gone on over the last decade since it's been launched, decade plus.
Yeah, but as you saw with Senator Bob Menendez, the U.S. dollar and gold are the preferred mechanism for any still the preferred mechanism for getting paid.
Menendez,
thank you. He had $480,000 of cash in his closet, and Colin Roche rightfully noted that he should fire his financial advisor because that $480,000 could be earning 5.5% risk free in T-bills or over $26,000 a year. So there's one thing I wanted to point in closing, and this is just a lesson behind the sort of things that come out of bad things. And if you look back at human history, there's a lot of examples of this. Like if you just Google the things that were discovered or inventions that were discovered in as a result of World War II, for example, when the world had to mobilize to defeat a nefarious enemy, things were discovered. I'm not going to go ahead and list them off right now, but obviously nuclear energy was developed at that point in time, which is a big part of our power picture. What I saw, and this is from Larry Hamtill, who we follow on Twitter often, this is something positive that came out of World War II that I thought was very interesting.
World War One.
Thank you. In the case of something good coming from, this is, I quote, something good coming from something terrible. Chemotherapy was derived from mustard gas when researchers noticed that mustard gas was destroying lymphatic tissue and bone marrow, and thought it might also be able to kill cancer cells in the lymph nodes. So what I just take away from that is human beings are incredibly resourceful. And there are what you might notice, and this isn't really related to anything, but I just thought this was something that was interesting, and I would leave you with that sort of note to ponder on. But there's all kinds of good that comes from bad, and that's one thing that Larry Hemsold rightfully noted that surprised me.
Yep. All right, well, we'll see you next week. As always, give us a 5-star review and share with your friends. This is Lane Yap Podcast with Doug and Greg Stokes. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Lane Yap. This podcast is brought to you by Stokes Family Office. If you liked this episode, consider sharing it with a friend. You can subscribe to future episodes in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about Stokes Family Office and Lane Yap, visit us at stokesfamilyoffice.com. The information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, it is not intended to be a substitute for specific, individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.